The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Here in America, work is in trouble. We've offshored our manufacturing, sent away good jobs, and lost so much ability to make things. American Giant is a company that's pushing back against this tide. They make high-quality clothing, sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. Visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, promo code STAPLE20.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, March the 28th, 2021. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media, and you get the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Well, welcome to another edition of the Talking Mets podcast, and we're down to the wire, less than a week before opening day, and, you know, I know everybody's getting excited about the season starting. I certainly am tired of spring training, to tell you the truth. I gotta be straight with you guys. I think we know where the positional battles are going. I know there's a couple of things left with the bullpen, and I think the bullpen, and if you go back to my original Talking Mets podcast on the roster a couple of weeks back, I was pretty on spot on. I think Jacob Barnes is going to make me look a little bad this season, which I'll be more than happy to do a mea culpa on that. But today, what I'm doing, before we get into a season preview and really dive into this whole thing, I wanted to do another one of these conversational type of podcasts. It went so well the last time with Mark Gold that I wanted to try something different. Now, this is a little different because not only do I have a lifelong Mets fan joining me today for a long conversation, and that's what I'll call this. This is a conversation. There's interviews, then there's conversations. And what I like to do on this show is do more conversations because I think that that's the entertainment value, and that's what makes it popular, and that's what makes you guys wanting to come back for more and really enjoy and get something out of it. But Devin Gordon is a lifelong Mets fan. He just wrote a book. So Many Ways to Lose. That's a book that's out, HarperCollins. It's called So Many Ways to Lose, The Amazing True Story of the Best Worst Team in Sports. It just came out. And I got to be honest, when I first started reading, and Devin has done a couple of articles for Sports Illustrated, I think GQ, highlighting some of the things that you'll find out in the book. And there's some interesting stories. There are things that you're going to learn. He dives deeper into the Bobby Bonilla payment. He talks about Bartolo Colon's home run, which, you know, why wouldn't we want to remember that? And gets into some other things about the Mets and, you know, situations, errors that maybe didn't go quite the way that we thought. But when I first saw it, I said, here's a guy, and who I didn't know he was a Mets fan when I first read it. Here's a guy that's using the old laugh out loud Mets to make some money, to make a name for themselves. And it does perpetuate, you know, embracing all of this. And I think at times, and I've said this a long time ago, you know, amazing and believe is a cool thing, but those are not sustainable winning principles. Those are hopes, and hope is not a way to run an organization. You know, you want, you know, sustainable infrastructure. That's really what you want, which is funny because that's really what the Mets fans want, and that's what maybe they're going to get as time goes on with their new owner. But as I got to talk to Devin and read up and really dive into it, not only is he a great guy and a big-time Mets fan, but I think what he's trying to do with this book is take Mets history, take everything. And in an era where, whether it's rule changes, the history of our country, anything, where we try not, you know, we want to erase and forget what goes on and only focus on what we want things to be. No matter how bad things are, it's important to embrace our past and learn from it. And not say that it's all good, not excuse it, not, you know, try to make, you know, things up that aren't real, not rewrite it, but really embrace it, look at it, and then move forward. And I think when I really thought about it, I said, what Devin's trying to do here is say, hey, yeah, this stinks. This was ridiculous. How many teams can not only fire a GM, but a manager before their first game in back-to-back years? I mean, think about how absurd that is. How if you put money down in Vegas, how unlikely that would be. So in all of this, I think his love for the Mets comes out. I think there's going to be self-deprecating times where you read it and, you know, you look at things that, like I did and say, well, you know, the 2000 Mets weren't that bad, right? That lineup wasn't that bad. But I understand where he's going. And I think when you listen, as I had a chance to catch up with him earlier this week, and we have this conversation, two guys that are in the media, two guys that have grown up Mets fans, have a passion for the team. And I think that that's important. And that's what I've always wanted to bring to this show. You know, this is not a fanboy show. I know that there's probably some people out there that will say that, members of the mainstream media. And I don't want it to be that. I want this to be something where the topic of conversation, you learn something, we debate. But the fact that I'm so ingrained in this for the 40-somewhat years of my life, and that passion that's underlying, I think wants, you know, makes the product better. And I think that's what Devin's trying to do here. So this is a situation where you judge a book by the cover, literally, and then you go and you do a little more research, you read it, and you talk to the guy, and it's a different take. And I'm glad I had a chance to meet Devin. You can check out Devin on Twitter, at DevinGordonX. And I think you're going to enjoy this conversation. And it's a long one, and it's going to be pretty much the entire show. So, yeah, I'm taking a quick break from spring training. I think that, you know, we'll be, you know, on the way out, I'll give you kind of an update on the show schedule and the plan. But sit back. Devin Gordon, author of the book, So Many Ways to Lose, The Amazing True Story of the Best Worst Team in Sports. We're going to talk about the Mets over their history, the heartbreak, some of the lowlights, where we were, what we were thinking, and maybe a what-if here or there. Who knows? So anyway, let's take a quick break. When I come back, Devin Gordon, author of the book, So Many Ways to Lose. We'll be back with that and more right after this. Hey, Mets fans. Opening day's right around the corner. I don't want you to forget about our sponsor, Manscaped. If you haven't tried it yet, go to manscaped.com. They are the global leader in grooming. Below the waist grooming, but in grooming. Over 2 million men worldwide have joined this movement. I've told everybody, Mets fans, Talking Mets podcast, Mets fans, you guys want to be part of it. If you want to be part of it, go to manscaped.com. Check it out. You get 20% off and free shipping with the code TALKINGMETS. No G. Very important. No G. You got the Perfect Package 3.0. Comes with one of the first-in-class grooming tools you'll ever have. You've got some great colognes. You've also got a nice travel kit. Just go check it out. Manscaped.com, 20% off free shipping. Code TALKINGMETS, no G, courtesy of me. I want to see you well-groomed for the 2021 baseball season. And if you're not interested, just pass by this and enjoy the rest of the show. All right, Manscaped.com. 20% off free shipping, code Talking Mets, and let's get back to Mets baseball. We're back, and joining me, Devin Gordon, author of the book, So Many Ways to Lose, The Amazing True Story of the New York Mets, the best, worst team in sports. New book that just came out. You can check out Devin on Twitter at DevinGordonX. He also has his own website. He wrote a nice piece a couple of years back about Gary, Keith, and Ron. DevinGordon.net, right, Devin? So
that's it. Yeah.
Welcome to the program. And look, there's the boys of summer for the Dodgers. The Yankees have all these iconic books about how great they are and the stuffiness. Yep. I think you try to put Mets fandom in kind of its own little boys of summer, I guess, type of book, maybe, right? Their like version, and encapsulate what it is to be a Mets fan in as much of a fun way as possible with some of the tough moments this franchise has had.
I mean, we're special, right?
Yeah.
We're special. There's no one like us. We have this uncanny ability to go in with unbridled optimism and this equal certainty that something terrible is about to happen, right? That's where we are right now, right?
Sure.
We've got all this, we've got the team, we're feeling good, the things that are happening on the field, cookie aside, okay. A little chaos behind the scenes, as usual, but on the field, feeling good. And I don't know about you, but I'm just worried about what we're going to do to Francisco Lindor this year. What are we going to do to this poor man? So that's a very unique thing, right? We have a unique thing as Mets fans. Yankee fans have a unique thing. They're jerks, right? They're the ultimate jerks as fans. We have a unique thing, which is that we're delightful. And I just, but we also lose, and we lose in a spectacular way and creative ways. And I just thought that that made us worth telling as a fan base. We had a story that no one was really telling.
Ron Darling used the comparison, I think, in one of the reviews as like Sisyphus, the old mythology, getting the rock to the top of the hill. I like to say, you know, they say Mets fans are a blue collar fan base, but I think the Mets encompass kind of like life. Like, let's face it, very few people live a charmed life where everything goes right.
Yeah.
And the Mets, yeah, they've had, and you outlined it in this book, so many of these crazy events. I mean, how many teams could fire a general manager and a manager back-to-back seasons? Ever. I was talking to somebody like that. To me, is probably the synopsis of this. But this is
sport without a game, without a single game for either of them.
We have put money down in Vegas on that because that's the only thing. You know, you and I wouldn't be doing this. We'd be off in the Bahamas right now. So, sports is a metaphor for life. But I really think the struggle and the constant ebbs and flows and the small wins that you take in. I wonder if you thought about that as you're writing the book, because there is a lot to be taken away. You know, the Mets are kind of a metaphor for the everyday fan, you know, the struggles we go through.
Yes.
Life isn't perfect for us. We have wins, but we have losses.
We do.
And things like that.
And that's an important thing that you just hit on with the Mets, which is, you know, sometimes we have this rep for being a bad team or, you know, these eternal losers. And as Mets fans, no, that's not us. You got it wrong. We win a peculiar amount for a team with the reputation for being awful that we have. We've been to the World Series more recent than those jerks across town in the Bronx. And what we do is we raise ourselves up to these giant heights to give ourselves something to plummet off of. And that's kind of like life, right? You have these highs, you have these lows. And very often those highest highs are made all the more pleasurable by the fact that they sort of smack you with a 2x4. You don't see them coming. You never would have guessed that they'd happen in this way. But the downside is that it happens in the other direction too, right? And like you said, that's life. The expectations that, say, Yankee fans have about how baseball should go, there's no life logic to that. That's not how any of us just winning year in and year out. Also, that just sounds boring. Like, what?
It's just
a miserable way to live.
But you would have liked to sort of, like, and I say this a lot of times, it would have been nice if we were sitting here talking, well, the Mets have had all these losses, but check out that dynasty in the 80s, 86, 88, 87, maybe a three-peat. You know, and that's where I guess the Yankee fan argument will be is, yeah, you embrace this history, and that's important to embrace the history, but it would have been nice to have a little bit more winning in between.
Have one dynasty rather than the sort of the almost dynasty. I mean, what's more Metsy than the dynasty we had in the late 80s where it's like we dominated, but we also were kind of simultaneously imploding. I mean, as you probably know, look, if we were under the playoff rules that we have now, the Mets would have been in the playoffs 5 times in 6 years, I think, or maybe all 6 years in the late 80s.
Pretty much, yep.
So we, you know, that's a bummer of history. That team now could easily have won 3 rings by performing exactly the same way they did, just maybe they roll into the wild, you know, they roll in as a wild card and steamroll everybody. In that moment, they won one World Series, one other division, and then that was it. And that's kind of a bummer for us as Mets fans. That's what our dynasty is. But I guess I get that argument. Maybe this is what we're going into. Maybe this is the Steve Cohen era. Maybe this is our dynasty moment.
Well, it's interesting because, and I know what you're talking about, you know, and I was thinking of this when the concept of the book came out. Go to any Mets game, big game, playoff, or even like a regular season game. I remember it was, you know, a couple of years ago, my brother called me. He was at a game. He said, you have no idea. As soon as that lead went from 8-2 to 8-4 to 8-5, the stadium got tense.
Yeah.
And I really believe in energy. You know, there's, and I think people are seeing this now with the no fans in the stands. There's a difference, certainly difference in the NBA, the NHL, but even baseball. I think the Mets, that 2019 team, fed off the fans. But there's always been this tension. If you've been to any Mets playoff game or any big game or any moment where the tension is like cut with a knife.
Yeah.
And you feel it. And I think it goes in and it puts maybe a weight on the players. This is a tough place. Steve Phillips has said it on SiriusXM. This is a tough job because you have all the expectations of the Yankees, none of the history, in the past, none of the money, and you get the same scorn. You get no breaks. And they're in the media, look, let's face it, this whole narrative, I'm sure you're getting a lot of requests for interviews, they eat it up. But a Mets fan at some point, this gets tiresome. They don't want to, sure. You know, it's great for your project and your book, but let's face it. I'm sure that at times, you know, during the history, as you remember these stories, you're like, it's not so fun for the fans that are on the other side.
Oh, no, it's often agonizing. You know, this process, this book is an act of catharsis, right? This is, you know, what is the old phrase? Comedy equals tragedy plus time.
Sure.
This took a long time for me to process this way. There's a chapter in the book entirely about the Endy Chavez catch, which is my favorite moment in Mets history. It was the best moment I was physically present for at Shea Stadium. I don't remember what happened next. You'd have to read the book to find out. You know, like it was, but like, you know, I haven't watched the Beltran at bat. I've never seen the video of it. I was there.
Wow.
And I won't watch it. Not even for this book, I didn't watch it.
Well, I'm going to give you some feedback. It's a hard at bat to watch because I've watched it. And I rerun that at bat. It's funny you bring that up because I remember watching it a couple of years ago. And I remember that first pitch. I'll tell you how that at bat. I'll give you a little precursor. That at bat was lost on the first pitch. Guy was on the hook, fastball down the middle. And I remember watching it live. And the funny thing is I watch it on the second round of it. And I'm like, that's where the at-bat was lost over there. But it's funny because you still feel the same emotions. You still feel that, you know, when you talk about disappointment, the Terry Pendleton home run, you're hoping that that ball stays in the ballpark.
Yes.
Mike Socha, the home run in 88, you're hoping that that doesn't happen.
What do you have, 36 lifetime home runs?
Yeah, and then one of the biggest thing off of Doc, and it's funny because I interviewed the late Gary Cotter, may God rest his soul, and I asked him when he was with the Long Island Ducks, I said, should Davey have brought in Myers? And he looked at me and said, no comment. So that's all it tells you. And that's true. I have it on the tape somewhere.
We could probably do 30 minutes just on that.
But it's interesting.
Right? Yeah.
As you're doing this book, are you remembering some of these moments like what I just talked about? And you're like, and is it bringing that rush of disappointment back and pain and hurt and things like that?
I mean, you know, one of the things, it's funny that you bring it up because of course I worry that Mets fans are going to have, like me, are going to recoil, have this sort of, hey, you know, easy on our team.
Right.
But we also have the other half of us where we're sort of, we have this built-in Casey Stengel sense of humor about ourselves that's just kind of carried through the generations.
Right.
And so I did worry that we would have, you know, people might have that response. And my hope was that by knowing that I'm a lifelong Mets fan myself and that it's written from that perspective, that people might interpret it as, oh, well, this is somebody who's processing grief through history and hopefully through humor so that we can look back on the things that we went through and laugh at them. But not all of them are funny stories, you know, like, you know, the way Cleon Jones was treated by the Mets in the 1970s is not a funny story. You know, what happened to Mackie Sasser is not a funny story,
but
it's very much, you know, stories like Cleon and stories like Mackie Sasser, which are tougher, certainly not funny stories about the Mets, but they're part of our history. And, you know, looking at our team through this filter of hope and frustration is an interesting prism. It's a different way, I think, to look at sports. But ultimately, it's actually how most of us end up experiencing sports. Like so many sports books wind up being written about the triumphant moments, the run to the title. Most Mets books tend to be about 86 and 69. But those years are the exceptions to the rule for us, right?
Sure.
The Mets, most of the Mets are the in-between, right? Like I look at 2019, which is such a weird year. I think we finished third. I think the record was like 83 and 79. I had a blast that season.
Yeah, it was fun. Fun second half.
That was really, really fun. And like, I can't imagine any Yankee fan ever describing a third place 83-79 season as anything other than an utter disaster. Whereas you and I can look at that season and be like, wow, Pete Alonso.
I'll tell you, one of the more fun, there's a couple of, the fact, I think 2019 is a fun season. And yeah, you have your 2015s and your 99s and your 2000s where you just come up short. But all, you know, some of the seasons, and you may have, you know, a few of those, like 1997, team was coming out of, you know, I remember 1997. I remember this vividly. Now, this is in the middle of the Knicks being like New York playoff team, you know, and all that stuff. And I remember I was in Miami on spring break. I was still in college. And they were doing a preview of the Mets coming into the season. Generation K was hurt. And a guy named Rick Reed was like one of their best pitchers. Nobody knew who he was. And they had them pegged for 100 losses.
Yeah.
And it was like, you know, you went through this five-year rebuild. These pitchers are hurt. All the optimism from the prior year, all gone. They have this guy, Bobby Valentine, that a lot of people don't like as the manager. And then the Knicks go out, they have that horrible loss to the Heat, and now your summer starts.
Gosh, right.
And you're like, you know, this is, I think, right around when Parcells was taking over a 1-15 Jets team. So there's a lot of negative stuff going on in New York. And here's this Mets team. You know, Yankees are a champion. You could not be further away from relevancy at that point.
Yep.
And here this team came out and competed and nearly made the playoffs. And began this climb back. And then obviously Piazza comes in the next year and the rest is history. But those are the kind of seasons, you're right. You don't get those everywhere.
I love
those. Would say that kind of, to me, that's like epitome of being a fan, 1997. Cause I remember that season and it was a hell of a lot of fun.
I love those seasons. I mean, what you're, you know, the season before you really put it together and maybe make a big postseason run, that where you can feel all that excitement. Wow, we got something here. Like for, you know, 84, which was the season that I basically started watching. I mean, I watched some baseball in 83 and had no idea what I was watching, but in 84, that's when I started to learn what baseball was and understand it. And 84 for the Mets was one of those seasons. It was, we got something here. This is getting exciting. They weren't ready. They were still a young team. They were 2 years away, but 1 year away from being really good, right? Like that 85 Mets team could have won the World Series if they had gotten past the Cardinals. That was a really good team. But 84 was where they were on the cusp. And 2019 felt like a maybe an on the cusp year. We'll never know because 2020 was such a weird thing. But 97 was like that, right? I love those seasons. What's funny about 2015 is I almost feel like we skipped past it in 2015, right?
Yeah. Like, it was like a
straight into the World Series
season. You woke up your friend and say, hey, let's go on this road trip. And it was, what's funny is that everyone loves 2015 and 2016, but when you really boil the Terry Collins era, you had about 12 weeks between two seasons of relevant baseball.
Yeah, basically.
And I know people get mad at me because I wasn't the biggest Terry guy. I don't think he was a great in-game manager. I know he was this folksy guy and he had the you know, the whole thing with the Syndergaard and Utley, and they love that little video of him going off on the umpires. But that was truly a 12-week season.
Yeah.
You never would have expected that, a 12-week season. And in a lot of ways, I wonder, you know, I look at the Mets now, and I've used this comparison on the show before. I remember going to Boston and doing tours of Fenway Park, 99, 98, 2000, and that was a pain fan base.
Yeah.
And look at what happened with one moment. Yeah. Everything turned around and look at where they are now. Now it's the Fenway Sports Group and the ballpark is not just the experience. The Mets are kind of in that almost that same way right now with a new owner.
Yeah.
They got money. They've got the good bones. Like the Red Sox of 2001 before Theo Epstein took on, look at those rosters. They had some good bones. They needed that next step. They needed those extra guys. And that's where they got in 2003 and 2004. And then now I look at the Mets kind of that way, and things could change a lot. Like this book could be like the ode to the old Mets. It's funny it came out this year because now you've got Steve Cohen, and it's not just about money, but is it about the mindset? Because this mindset sometimes, what you're pointing out, is a very true mindset, but it could be what's held the franchise back in a lot of ways.
Yes.
Amazing and Believe is cool, but Amazing and Believe are not – I used to say Amazing and Believe are not sustainable infrastructure for a baseball team. That's not – you know, and it sounds like a corporate boardroom – But let's face it, it's not sustainable. It's aggravating sometimes. Like, you know, it's got to be more than just hope and a prayer.
It's going to be interesting to see what Cohen brings in, right? Because I do think that there's almost this test of what our DNA really is. Because, you know, the Wilpons were willing to spend money haphazardly off and on. Like, they'd spend money and then feel stupid for the money they spent, and then they wouldn't spend money. And then things would go to crap, and then they'd be forced to spend money again. And it never seemed like there was any real logic behind it. Cohen definitely feels more like there's a purpose to the things that he does. And the guy is obviously a competent businessman, and he runs things well. Now, does that mean that he can cure the Metsiness in our DNA?
Well, so far, the positive vibes are there, but there's a lot of weird stuff. I mean, Jared Porter, Trevor Bauer saga.
There? It's still there.
But it got snuffed out. But think about it. It got snuffed out pretty quick. I think under the old regime, that might have spiraled. And think about it. Look how historically significant what they're doing right now. A new owner comes in on November 1st. They have to hire – Alderson's the president, comes back. They have to hire a GM. They have to do it in the middle of free agency. There's no pre-planning. This is truly like on the fly. And let's face it, no one's given them a curve. This is not like school where, like, you know what? I'll give you a break. You know, you took the team over on November 1st. The rest of the league doesn't care. The media doesn't care. The Mets fail and they don't make the playoffs. They will be treated the same as if Steve Cohen took over in August of last year and had 12 weeks to prepare for the offseason and build infrastructure. Nobody cares. That's the amazing part. And if they do win, and let's say they do put it together this year, I think it's historically significant. And it is part of that weirdness of being the Mets, this whole weird storyline. And I think that's what's missing in sports today. The stories are gone. Yeah. It's all numbers. And I think we could do more of that storytelling. That's why I got into this, is storytelling, not because of Battagan.
Yeah, I mean, me too. And the other thing I would add to that is sometimes as sports fans, we feel like we've been told the same story over and over and over again. And it's just repackaged, and maybe it's different names, it's different emotions. I think too many sports journalists and sports storytellers, frankly, focus on winning and stories that end with winning a little too much, because they think that people want that rousing goosebumps, but it's a little artificial, right? It's a simulacrum of something that actually happened years and years earlier. And all you're really trying to do is conjure that thing over, but it's not the real thing. The storytelling is the thing. And if you give people a really original story that they haven't heard before, even if it doesn't necessarily have a happy ending, the journey that it can take you on, like, there's a chapter in my book about a stadium, about a building, but it's Shea Stadium.
Right.
Shea Stadium is an incredibly colorful building with an amazing story behind it. And I don't think sports fans are used to thinking about a building as the subject of a great sports story. And right. I'm hoping that that's what'll, you know, show them who the Mets are. And if you're a Mets fan, you'll identify with, oh yeah, Shea Stadium really is a part of who we are. That is the spirit of the Mets, that building. There's something perfectly Metsy about the entire history of Shea Stadium. And that's what makes us special. You know, like I said, certainly back to us being special. The Reds don't have this. The Diamondbacks don't have this. And I'm really proud of our team. You know, we have two rings in our history, but I think we're the most fun team to root for in baseball. So I'm okay with that.
I couldn't argue with that. The book is So Many Ways to Lose, The Amazing True Story of the New York Mets, The Best Worst Team in Sports, Devin Gordon. Devin, you have so many stories, I'm sure, that you learned during this. So as we get to the back half of this, I'm curious, you became a fan around the time that I was, mid-80s, you know, around there. So there's this whole 25, 26 years of Mets history that you weren't around for. Now you heard stories, but let's face it, there's not as much about those teams nuanced as there is. I mean, I can find a lot of stuff about the 2005 Mets now with the internet era.
Yeah.
Give me a story that maybe from that pre-Devin Gordon fandom that you learned and you were like, I never knew that. It was something that really stood out to you. A story that, you know, really blew you away. And like, oh, wow, I can't believe that. I'm a Mets fan. Did you learn anything like that writing this book?
You know, for some reason, maybe it's because of my sense of storytelling and the fact that my mind's always going to something that makes me laugh. The dark years immediately after my birth and before I became a Mets fan, the late 70s, when the team was falling to pieces. The original family, the Paysons, falling out of love with the team. Let's say Mrs. Payson's husband never particularly liked the Mets. He was a horse racing guy. And once she died, and the team went bad and they dealt away Tom Seaver, they started hemorrhaging money really badly. And one thing that they did, and I love this so much, I dedicated a whole chapter to it, is that for a brief year or a brief period in the late 70s, they actually fired Mr. Met. Loving father and husband, and replaced him with a mule, a live actual mule that they named Metal, M-E-T-T-L-E, because they wanted a symbol of unglamorous grit and determination to be the symbol of the Mets. And so they literally made the symbol of the Mets a rented old broken down mule. And they ended up, it turned out, and this only occurred to them later, the demise of Metal the Mule was brought on because it turns out that mules need to be fed and they require care and feeding. And you have to store them in humane facilities. And all of these things cost money, whereas you can pay Mr. Met 9 to 5.
Right. Yeah, the mule can't go home to the house after the ball game's over. You got to take care of the mule at that point.
If the mule takes a dump in center field, you can't fire the mule. If Mr. Met does that, you can
fire. You can fire and bring someone. That's funny.
I just thought that was, you know, just a Metsy story. And an amazing moment that I just couldn't believe happened in our history. And, you know, there are great moments like the imperfect game, you know, the Tom Seaver near perfect game in the summer of 69. That was a game that I knew about by name. I'd heard of the imperfect game. I knew the story of it. I knew it was a big deal for the Mets in 1969. But when I started to do the research on it, I was like, oh, my God. Like, if I could transport myself back to any Mets game before my birth, I wouldn't go to game 5 in 69. I'd go to this one. I'd go to this one because that's when the Mets franchise was born. That night when Seaver nearly threw a perfect game. That was when the Mets were like, oh, my God, we're real. We're a team now.
Yeah.
And everyone was there. Friday night at Shea, 58,000 people. Think about that now. Shea was a huge stadium.
Real big ballpark. And it was loud and it would shake. Yeah. I always tell the story about you sit in the upper deck. And I remember this very vividly. Last row of the upper deck. And Devin's on video and he's doing the bouncing up and down over here. But I remember game 3 of the NLDS in 2000. Alfonso ties the game, 8th inning off of Rob Nen with a base hit. I was up in that last row, and I'm thinking to myself, this place falls. At least I'll be on top of everybody to cushion me. But it's scary. It's scary.
Amazing you had that thought, because that's where I was sitting in 2006 in Game 7 when I made that catch. And I had the same exact thought. I think this deck might fall.
This
and
fall from the
buzz. Does, it's a great way to die.
I really did. You can see the catch. There you go.
If this is how I'm going out.
That's right.
Great. And you know what? I kind of wish I had given
that was a tough. Well, I will give you advice. Maybe after this interview, you could go watch the Beltran at bat. At least watch it and go. You put your hands over your eyes. Now, you had a chance as part of the promotion for the book. You have a couple of publications. You wrote a piece in GQ. You wrote a piece in Sports Illustrated. The Bartolo Colon home run, that's a great piece. I recommend everybody goes and checks that out. Sports Illustrated did a nice job breaking down the history of the broken bat and Piazza Clemens. I had forgotten about the broken bat. I'll tell you what, Piazza's been on this program, and I sent them that article, and I said, hey, you remember because you talked to him quite a while before on that.
It was like almost 2 years.
Yeah, he did remember that particular.
We're trying to get him the book, but we don't know where he is. I think he's back in Florida. I don't know where he is. We're trying to get it to him.
Yeah, Jay Horowitz. That's how you get it to Jay Horowitz. But you did a nice piece about Bobby Bonilla and Bobby Bonilla Day. And here's why Bobby Bonilla Day drives me crazy. Bobby Bonilla Day drives me crazy because the Mets are not the only team that do deferred payments. By the way, I think Bruce Sutter is still on the Braves payroll. Yes. Brett Saberhagen might be on the Royals and the Mets payroll. And Gene Garber, I'll throw names that I've seen deferred payments. There's always, it's amazing how
it's not that big
private information now is part of like payroll, and what people make is part of public knowledge. Like it really shouldn't be, but it's amazing on that. So Bobby Bonilla is getting these crazy deferred payments. They happen to be the Mets, the team that stands out, maybe because it's Bobby Bow, maybe because it's so much money, maybe because it seems like it's in perpetuity. But you had a chance to talk to his old agent, Dennis Gilbert. Now, here's my takeaway. Dennis Gilbert lives in Malibu, not cheap. Beautiful, not cheap. Too little close to nature. That's the whole thing between the hurricane, you know, the fires and Mother Nature with water having its own little, you know, revenge. I'd love to have like a summer home there, but not my primary residence. But anyway, so Dennis Gilbert's living in Malibu, so he's clearly benefiting from this check. Let me put it that way.
Good.
And he's in the insurance business. And I don't know about you, Devin. Insurance is a nice, you know, career. I don't know if it's Malibu good. So I think he's kind of doing pretty well on this Bobby Bonilla payments. But he actually talked about how this came about. And it was not an easy negotiation. And it looks like the Mets thought, or the Mets might have won that transaction more than people think based on the article that you wrote.
Yeah, I mean, well, let me say this about Dennis Gilbert, who was a delight to speak with because we did it on Zoom. I can't remember if I put that part in the article because I had to edit it down. But in the book, it's a little bit more detailed. My interaction with Dennis was a little bit more detailed. And we were doing it on FaceTime. And he was doing his sort of, you know, he's in his 70s. So he was doing his sort of daily exercise. And his daily exercise consisted of a walk around his Malibu property, around his Malibu estate. And as far as I could tell, and we were on the phone for like an hour, he took one lap around his estate. In an hour.
Yeah.
And, you know, what? One of the things that he said to me was, you would think being an agent for major athletes would be far more lucrative than being in the insurance business for these athletes. You would be wrong. He left being a sports agent for people like Bobby Bonilla because he was like, there's no money in this for me. That's how much more it is.
Might have been about a decade to, well, he probably was on the back end. When he got out, was right after Bonilla, right? They were starting to get big money.
That's true.
And I think, look, we talk about $5 million in 2000, still big money, but, you know, not like what you see today with $300 million.
No, that's
deals,
true. And maybe that's a different economics. I mean, he clearly.
But the aggravation level, far less, not people stealing your clients, guys like you and that's I true. Calling them up, all that stuff. But, it's interesting how that has become a thing. And I laugh when I read that. I'm like, the Wilpons thought they had all this money in Madoff. And you know what? I'll just take the money, defer it. I'll invest this $5 million. Yeah. And that $30 million that they're paying out Bonilla, that'll be $90 million with Madoff. Who would have known? You know, too good to be true, right?
Yeah.
That whole thing. So, but listen,
that was
not a bad deal for Bonilla. I got to give the guy credit. His agent sat down and said, when you retire, the spigot turns off and not everybody has the discipline to save. This is the ultimate savings account. I mean, he's getting paid more than middle relievers right now into
and
his 70s.
Another one from Baltimore.
Oh, I didn't know. Wow, that's amazing.
I think I had to cut that from the article. Cooper Spacey's
coming smart.
From Baltimore. Like, look, this is, and I think one of the things that you're hinging on is like Dennis Gilbert himself is always like, what's the big deal? Like he did not invent this.
No.
It was unusual. It wasn't like, you know, it happened, but he didn't invent it. It was a tactic that some people had done and it became much more popularized, but it's not like some ingenious con that they came up with. So he's always been a little mystified about it. And it is a good question. Like, what is it about it? And I think it's just that combination of our antipathy for Bobby Bow as a fan base, deserve it or not, we can,
And he's a good, and you know what? When you look at Bobby Bonilla, I was looking at his numbers the other day. I kind of got sparked by what you did. 2,000 hits, nearly 300 home runs, really every year, offensive guy, lousy attitude, lousy defensive player, probably should have been in the American League as a DH. But by today's standards, he'd have a job because of his offense.
And
he played multmultiple positions, third, first.
Even with the Mets, corners. His first year was a disaster. Ask Carlos Beltran about that. That's not a thing.
New York isn't easy. And that's what Lindor, you know, I want to warn people. Beltran had a tough first year. Bonilla had it tough, and then his numbers after that were good. Yeah, the team was bad, but numbers were good. Piazza, and I've talked to Mike on the show about this, not easy his first couple of months on in New York, and then he had the big September. You know, things could have gone very differently there. So, you know, look, it's not easy, and Bonilla is a cautionary tale in that sense. It takes time to adjust to
you. And so, you know, so he's, you know, underperforms, even though his numbers were pretty good after that year. The team was so not just bad, but dislikable, right? So there's that. And then there's, of course, on the opposite end of it, there's the Wilpons, right? And all of this kicks in 2011, right? That's when the Bonilla payments start in 2011. And 2011 is one of the nadirs of our franchise, right? That's, you know, that's the year in which we're paying Bonilla at one point more than the starting outfield that the Mets
did,
right? And so I think there's that combination of like, this guy now, we're paying this guy now when we can't even field the team. So I think it's that stew of negativity when in the moment, if you're looking at the deal in the moment, both sides won, worked out great. Worked out great for us, worked out great for him. He's got his money. We almost beat the Yankees.
God bless
him. Series. Wonderful. But we don't like win-win deals, do we? Like, as sports fans, we don't like the win-winness. Whereas I actually kind of find the win-win really interesting just because it's an unusual outcome. And if you look closer at those moments, they're usually more fun stories to tell.
Absolutely. And Bobby's gained a few pounds in his retirement. Go Google some pictures of recent interviews. He's gained a few pounds. He's eating well.
So you know what I think is interesting about him? He's still in baseball.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
This is a guy, for whatever we think about
Players Associates, we're involved with the Players Association. Yeah.
This is a guy who loves.
Would he not talk to you? So Gilbert talked to you. I'm assuming Bonilla wouldn't talk to you, right?
He doesn't
want nothing to do.
I mean, I think if I had showed up, maybe that was, I thought, you know, one of the things that I thought I might try to do was just try to show up somewhere he'd be. I mean, I reached out. I asked Dennis Gilbert if he thought he'd talk to me. He's like, he's not going to talk to you about that. It's one of the difficult things is I would have really liked to talk to Bobby about a lot of things, because I also think that his record in New York, when we look back at what we know about the media and race and the way that played into things, particularly in that era, I think it doesn't mean we need to let Bobby Bo off the hook, but I do think we need to relook at it a little bit.
It was a tough situation. And look, a guy from Pittsburgh probably shouldn't have been in New York. Probably not, you know, let's put it this way. Was expected to be Strawberry. Not fair.
He came.
Not fair to be Strawberry.
Brought in to be Daryl Strawberry.
Yeah, that's just not fair.
South Bronx, everybody.
He was not Strawberry. Right.
And he was not that guy. And he came in thinking that he was going to be welcomed with open arms because he was coming home. He's a big smiley guy. And instead, he came to New York that had just been battle scarred by this team that just, you know, fireballed out of existence. And they're like, knock that smile off your face, kid, and get out and win.
You got to win.
And it just never, it from jump. And then you have the fact that the team that we thought he was being brought in to lead just turned out to be horrible, right?
I mean,
horrible team. And as Mets fans, we knew that. Like, I didn't want to root for Vince Coleman. I didn't want to like Vince Coleman. I liked hating Vince Coleman. But now all of a sudden, that's the team that he's got built around. And this is not a winning team. So when you look at Beltran, who had a terrible first year, his second year, he's got a much better team around him, right? So it doesn't fall as hard on him. Pedro is there. Reporters can
Delgado, Reyes. It's not just him expecting to carry the load.
It's not just
in a lot of ways, Beltran, I feel like that strikeout that you mentioned, and the reason I bring it up because you mentioned it, that's his legacy, and he was so much better than that.
Yes.
And let me tell you something. I know you haven't watched it, but I'll tell you, that curveball, tough pitch. That's as much Adam Wainwright as it is. And that's typically Mets fans. You know, this is a tough fan base. And I said this with Cano and anybody who plays for the Yankees or comes here, you know, there's a harder grade for those guys.
Yeah.
I think it'll be interesting because, you know, with this book and what you bring up, if Lindor and this marriage comes to fruition, and it may, there's reports that they're starting to make progress. This is his team now.
Yeah.
This is his team. Him and Conforto, if they sign, they're the two core offensive players. Everybody else will bounce off. they're going to be judged.
This is right.
Not DeGrom. DeGrom will always get the out because, you know, his 8 innings. He did his 7 innings. And you know what? They'll always – it's going to be them. And if and it'll be interesting to see how that relationship evolves. Now, here's something interesting as we wrap up here. In the spirit of your book, give me a Mets player that you – that's not Strawberry. It's not Seaver. It's not Doc. A guy that you connect with that you really like, because I'll give you mine, because we mentioned him earlier, but I'll give you mine, and I liked them as a kid. But someone less overt,
yeah,
that when you bring him up, the fans will go, oh, I remember that guy. But he's kind of like your guy or somebody that you connected with. What do you got for me?
The book is the dedication in the book. The book is dedicated to my family, but it is also dedicated to Andy Chavez.
Andy Chavez. So that would have been, oh, that's so obvious in front of the whole thing. So obvious.
I love Andy. There's a whole chapter about Andy. I got to speak to him for a while for the book. And that was one of the, my heart breaks about that catch because he deserved to have the best postseason catch of all time. The most crucial, critical, dramatic. He deserved it. He did it. All we had to do was finish off the game and win.
And did you see him jumping in the snow recently on Instagram?
I loved it.
There you go. So he's still doing the catch, right?
I actually texted him after that to say,
oh, that's great.
Because it was basically right when I had gotten hardcover copies of the book. So it was basically an excuse to be like, oh my gosh, I actually have a book. Can I send it to you right now? What's your address? I'm going to send it to you. And, you know, he is a huge defender of Beltran. He says, like you said about that curveball, which I have not and will not watch, Andy's view of that curveball, and remember, Andy was standing on second base. Nobody in the world had a better view of that curveball than Andy.
Right.
He said it was unhittable. He's like,
oh, it was unhittable. Yeah.
He's like, nobody is hitting that pitch. He's like, sometimes as a hitter, you just get a pitch.
You get beat. You get beat.
And he's like, look, I had an opportunity to come through right after I made that catch. I was up with the bases loaded in the bottom of the next inning.
Yep. And he struck out. Yeah. He could have hit a fly. Yeah.
And it's a thing that, you know, like it crushes me that that's how that game ended. And so the chapter for Andy was like my way to sort of write him into history, to give him what he deserved.
I'll share this with you. I know I'm keeping you long, but there's a, I'll share this with you. Cause I think of Andy. I was at the last game at Shea Stadium. I was sitting down the left field line in the orange seats, maybe like 15, 20 rows back. Here's how good a defensive player he was. I can remember this play. I think bases loaded. This is before it was a tie game. If you remember, Beltran hit a home run to tie it that day. And there was a line drive down the left field line, a pretty nice well hit. Can't remember if it was a Dan Uglow or somebody. And Andy goes back, and as he's going back, he's lefty. He goes like this, kind of like one of these going back. It just plucks the ball. And I remember watching it. And I know the listeners aren't seeing this, but turns his glove as a lefty the opposite way. He goes, boop. And I'm like you think about how good you got to be. And so casually, just going, boop.
That's what one of the things I love.
And he was a very good fielder.
He's not a superhuman guy, right?
Nope.
Not a superhuman. He's not the physique. He's a relatively small guy. I think he's 5'11". He's never, didn't have the power to be a home run hitter. Holy crap, was he good at baseball. He was, as a pure baseball player, he was as good as anyone on that team. Just wasn't, you know, built the way you need to. He didn't have the physical tools. But, God, as a fielder, if you watch that play, and it is as perfect a crystalline snowflake of a defensive play you will ever see. And he deserves to go down in history for it. And if my book can do anything, it is to –
This interview could do anything. It gives Andy Chavez credit. I'll give you two names. One is probably not a really should get. Mackie Sasser, I loved him as a kid. Mack the Hack, that was a guy. Loved Mackie. Mackie was on before he got that ankle injury with Presley sliding into him in 1990. Yep. He was on pace to be a really good catcher.
Yep.
Now, maybe by today's standards, the catch and throw, he wasn't a great receiver, but that staff didn't mind him. Everything went downhill. And he's been on my program, and he was on HBO Real Sport. And it's an interesting psychological story, Max.
There's a whole chapter in the book,
so you can read about that in Devin's book. And then the other guy is probably less over is John Olerud. I've always liked John Olerud. I like Al Leiter is probably not a guy that counts. Al Leiter, I like. It's funny. I'm a little, and I've been, you know, and you can see this. I got a bunch of memorabilia up. I've been redecorating my home man cave. My wife hates it. She doesn't like the spacing. But I'm going. I said, you know, we got some stimulus money. Let me share the wealth with people who have, you know, could use it, eBay, small businesses, places like that. And I'm putting up these memories of Al Leiter, and I'm finding great action photos. You know, I got a picture of Al raising his hands after beating the Reds. And I'm saying, you know, that's what this fandom is all about.
Yeah.
You know, there's, yeah, you only got a couple pennants. You only got a couple World Series, but there's nothing to be ashamed about. I could create my own man cave. I don't have 27 World Championships. I don't have the history of the Cardinals. But you have these moments, and let's face it, I can remember when Mike Piazza got traded, where I was. I remember, you know, events because of sports. I had Larry Olmsted, who just wrote a book about fans, on the show a couple weeks ago, talking about how healthy it is to be a fan. Tying that into this, obviously, all this disappointment, and we'll wrap up on this, this hasn't made you a worse person. You're a successful writer. You're a happy guy. You know, you look healthy and happy. You know, you love Andy Chavez. You've met all these guys that, you know, you probably never thought about you would meet, you know, 15 years ago. So as we wrap up, you know, give the listeners an idea of what's next for you, what you got coming up. And obviously they could check out DevinGordon.net and your GQ article and all the other stuff you got going on. And obviously buy the book.
Yeah. I'm not really sure. I'm hoping I'm going to get to write another book. I've got a bunch of ideas.
Is it Mets related, or your books will be something else?
No, this one will be, there's a couple of sports ideas. There's a baseball idea. There's a football idea that I'm really excited about. Hopefully the book does well enough that I get a chance to do it. I'll be doing, you know, magazine articles, mm-hmm. You know, back to writing for The Atlantic and for ESPN and some of the other places that I've been writing for. But mostly, hopefully I'll be talking about this book. I mean, you know, I think it's going to be an entertaining season, and things are going to come up that probably evoke things that may have happened earlier. You know, I was going to say, since you brought up John Olerud, maybe I'll just leave with this. I assume you, do you know the great Ricky Henderson story about John Olerud?
Yeah, that he didn't know John Olerud, and they say it's never true that he actually knew John Olerud. But yeah. Glendon Rush was funny that Ricky used to call Glendon Rush. He was on the show a couple of weeks back, and he used to call him Lefty. He didn't know his name. He used to call him Lefty. And he took a cab with Pat Mahomes, and Glendon Rush and Ricky to the stadium. And he said, Pat Mahomes used to say, "Hey, Ricky, what's his name?" And he points to Glendon Rush, and Glendon Rush would say, "What's his name?" And he'd say, "Lefty. That's Lefty. That's Lefty." So he knew he threw left-handed, but he couldn't remember Glendon Rush's name.
Ricky Henderson is a delightful figure, one of my all-time favorites. Just I love characters, and Ricky Henderson was such a great character. And I know it didn't end very well for us with Ricky.
But he had a great night without Ricky in 1999. The Mets do not make the playoffs. They do not beat the Reds. They don't make the playoffs.
Exactly. And it was an incredible season for a 40-year-old guy. And Dennis Gilbert actually works with him, too. And, you know, Ricky used to refer to himself all the time in the third person. And apparently Dennis Gilbert says it really embarrassed him that he got known for that. So that he's sort of worked on trying to lick that habit.
I think it was shtick and it was fun. That's interesting. It just goes to show you there's a human side to a lot of these guys. And I'm sure you saw it. Well, here's the deal I'll make with you. We'll keep in touch. And when the Mets make the World Series and win, you're the first guy I'm bringing on. I'm telling you, because I'll tell you a funny, real, you know, when I first saw the book come out, I was like, oh, why is somebody doing this? They're celebrating Mets losingness. It's going to perpetuate the narrative. But I think you did a nice job in taking a difficult situation, making it fun, and tying it into Mets history. And I could see you want to embrace this. It's not meant to poke fun. Now, there's going to be sports talk shows. They're going to use this the wrong way. You know that, and I know
that's
that.
That's fine. That's fine.
But I think that you meant to make this more of a Mets history. And with the new era starting, perfect timing to...
Perfect timing. You know, this is when we're closing this chapter, and the new Mets are going to be something different.
And I'll say this, and this is truly it. When they do become a dynasty under Steve Cohen, what we'll say is it couldn't have happened any other way. It makes Terry Pendleton worth it. It makes 2000 and losing to the Yankees worth it. It makes Andy Chavez worth it. It makes Beltran strikeout worth it. It couldn't happen any other way. So, Devin, thank you so much. You've been generous. I know I kept you long, but this was fun.
No, I had a blast. I love talking to Mets fans. This is great.
And let's follow you on Twitter now. Let's keep in touch, and we'll do this again, my friend. All righty?
Thank you so much.
And that's Devin Gordon. And the book is So Many Ways to Lose, The Amazing True Story of the New York Mets, The Best Worst Team in Sports. Devin Gordon X on Twitter. Interesting stuff. It's funny how I wasn't sure how that would go. And again, like I did with recently in a couple of weeks ago, just a couple of guys talking baseball. And I think we'll do more of that. And I promise that it's not just authors. And I know we had Mark Gold on, And we'll do more of that. And I think it's fun. It's a way to get through the season and everybody learn about their Mets experience. So, all right, let's take a quick break. We'll wrap up. You're listening to the Talking Mets podcast. We'll be back with more right after this. Hey, Mets fans, opening day's right around the corner. I don't want you to forget about our sponsor, Manscaped. If you haven't tried it yet, go to manscaped.com. They are the global leader in grooming. Below the waist grooming, but in grooming. Over 2 million men worldwide have joined this movement. I've told everybody, Mets fans, Talking Mets podcast, Mets fans, you guys want to be part of it. If you want to be part of it, go to manscaped.com, check it out. You get 20% off and free shipping with the code TALKINGMETS. No G, very important, no G. You got the Perfect Package 3.0. Comes with one of the first-in-class grooming tools you'll ever have. You've got some great colognes. You've also got a nice travel kit. Just go check it out. Manscaped.com, 20% off free shipping. Code TALKINGMETS, no G, courtesy of me. I want to see you well-groomed for the 2021 baseball season. And if you're not interested, just pass by this and enjoy the rest of the show. All right, Manscaped.com, 20% off free shipping. Code TALKINGMETS, and let's get back to Mets baseball. All right, we're back. Final thoughts. I thought that was a great segment, great conversation. I hope you enjoyed it. Something just to gear up. I mean, we're going to start getting into the nuts and bolts of the season, games, and the Mets look good. And I think this is going to be a fun season and certainly a season that we all expect the Mets to be in a playoff run and make the playoffs. I mean, what that looks like, I think, remains to be seen. But a couple of things I took away as I'm talking to Devin. One, I was always wondering, and you'd be curious if you guys want to send me feedback either on Twitter at Mike Silva Media or at Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Remember, no G. I always have to say that because people still are emailing me with a G. Do you ever watch an old game that you know what the outcome is, but you're watching it and you're hoping for a different result? It was funny. There's a book out. And I cannot remember who wrote it, but it's written in the 80s. It's about Game 6 of the 1986 National League Championship Series. I'm going to try to find it. The best game ever played. I don't think it's Jack Lang that wrote it, but it's a longtime sports writer. Anyway, I'll find it some other time. But anyway, as I was looking for that book, which some people are selling for like $80 used paperback on Amazon. Think about that. It's not something you can find on Kindle. The Astros fans in the comments are talking about how they watched that game and they're hoping for a different outcome. That's the Astros fans of Game 6 of the NLCS. And I think about Game 1 of the World Series. I remember last year during the pandemic when Yes had it on and I'm watching. And what's funny is everybody talks about that ninth inning with the walk to Paul O'Neill or Timo Perez not running things out. But if you watch the top of the ninth, Mike Bordick almost hit a home run that just missed going out to right field. And the Mets didn't execute and get the insurance for him. But think if that ball goes in that little short porch and right the opposite way, Mike Bordick hits a two-run homer. The Mets probably put that sucker away. I think about the Carlos Beltran at bat. Watching that ninth inning, I've seen that. And hoping that Reyes' line drive doesn't get caught by Edmonds or that Beltran swings at that first fastball. You think about that. You think about, obviously, some of the moves that Terry Collins could have made differently in the 2015 World Series. Socha in 88, watching that at bat. You know, as a Knicks fan, so many things I could look at, whether it be the John Starks three-pointer in 94, the Charles Smith play in 93. So many things you could look at in those seasons where, you know, if something went different, maybe the outcome is different. So it's funny that as we're talking about it, we're talking about how he has not seen Game 7 of the 2006 NLCS. And I've watched that about a couple of times. And you're right, the juices come back. And it's funny how as a fan that that happens. And I'm curious if you guys have moments like that, whether it's the Terry Pendleton home run or maybe Piazza's home run not go, you know, ball that dies somehow in center field in the Subway Series for the final out. A ball that to this day, I don't know how it didn't go out. So things like that. The second thing I was thinking of, and I was looking this up during the break, and you're all going to kill me on this. This will probably get me the most negative fanfare. But Bobby Bonilla is such a negative name in Mets history. you could even look up Bobby Bonilla memorabilia, and there's so few of it with him in a Mets uniform. And if there is, it's a very generic situation. And everybody's always going to remember him, at least until he's, you know, what, whatever the last payment is sometime in 2032 or whatever it is. So you've got well over another decade of Bobby Bonilla Day, even though there's other teams that are paying Bruce Sutter and Brett Saberhagen and guys like that. I mean, if you went to some of these payrolls, I think, you know, Spot Track, I think you'll see other names that come up from the 80s that are getting annuities, so to speak, from teams. But if you look at Bobby Bonilla's career as a Met, which is 5 seasons total, and the only team he played more for were the Pirates. Those were his golden years. Bobby Bonilla was a pretty damn good hitter. Here's a guy that hit 270 as a Met. He had 95 home runs in his career. He had an 850 OPS, a 128 OPS plus. He played multiple positions. He played third. He played right. He played first. He played left. And if he was on a good team and wasn't expected to be the man, I don't know if he would be viewed the same. Now, what happened in 99 with him coming back and at a time where he still wanted to be a full-time player and all the stuff with the cards and the dugout and all that other stuff, it's a whole different situation. And he was brought back, and probably the Mets, they were trying to get rid of Rojas's contract. Mel Rojas was a disaster with the Mets. They probably should have thought twice about bringing Bobby into that situation. And look, Benny Agbayani took his job. That happens. Young player, played well, was a big offensive piece of that team. You know, maybe Benny wasn't a star, but in that lineup, he did just enough to take his job, probably what you expected Bonilla to do. But when you look at him during his first tenure, and he was traded to the Orioles as a big transaction. I mean, the Orioles gave up Alex Ochoa, a top prospect in that deal, for Bobby Bonilla. Mets were trying to get Benitez in that deal. If you go back, Benitez was a big prospect. Mets were trying to get Benitez as well. I mean, Alex Ochoa was a top prospect, 5-tool player, a guy that Mets thought would be part of the solution. We know what happened. Maybe that ties into the whole theme of so many ways to lose. But when you look at Bonilla in context, he is every bit the offensive player during his Mets career, just Mets career, that Michael Conforto is. And Michael Conforto is about to get a big contract. He's a better hitter than Howard Johnson, if you want to look at some of the total numbers. Kevin McReynolds, Rusty Staub, who everybody likes. Edgardo Alfonso, who is beloved. Daniel Murphy. You know, he's a shade under Carlos Beltran. Not that much different than David Wright, by the way, guys. Now, you have your elite all-time hitters in Mets history. Strawberry's number one, if you want to just do OPS+. Piazza, number two. You could argue either way. But think about that. So as much as we dislike, and I'm trying to reframe Bonilla, maybe it was wrong place, wrong time in Mets history. Take a younger Bobby Bonilla who was given that big contract, and in a lot of ways he earned that contract. Now, he was the highest paid player in baseball. He was asked to replace Strawberry. Unfair in both fronts. He was in the right place at the right time. He and Danny Tartable that offseason. Both got big contracts. One went to the Mets, one went to the Yankees. So it's funny that Bobby Bonilla is known as this awful signing and this awful guy. And look, wasn't probably a good fit for New York. Not the first guy. Won't be the last. But don't criticize the production, at least the first tenure. Forget 99. Remember, those numbers include 1999, a disastrous tenure where he was essentially, after the first month of the season, regulated to, you know, the 25th man on the roster. I mean, Bobby Valentine probably could have made him the 80th man on the roster if he could. Maybe that was a bad mix, him and Bobby V. Who knows? So, way better as a Met offensively than Gary Carter. Gary's beloved, but Gary's overall was slightly above league average. I mean, Gary had a great 85, great 86, started to decline in 87, and fell off the cliff. Catchers do that. That happens. So I was just thinking about that as we talked about Bobby Bo, and I thought it was an interesting story and how Devin was able to get Dennis Gilbert and all that other stuff. So anyway, that's my thoughts about this segment. I hope you enjoy it. Think about those two things. I'd like to hear from you guys. My thoughts on Bobby Bo and also what I had to say about you going back and looking at some old games, really watching them, and then your juices get going, and then you're hoping for a different outcome. Of course, we know reality. That tape's not going to change. You're not going to magically have some kind of butterfly effect here and go and all of a sudden change the course of Mets history with whatever we're watching at that point. All right, I want to thank Devin Gordon for joining me today. You can check out his book, So Many Ways to Lose. Also, check out Devin Gordon X at Devin Gordon X on Twitter. You could check me out all the time at Mike Silva Media on Twitter. Of course, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, no G. And you can get the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your week. We will have a season preview show coming up midweek. Sit tight, stay tuned. Till then, be well, everybody.
These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make all kinds of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country. And jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.